Welcome to Expats and Allies, a show dedicated to exploring how Nazi war criminals found refuge in North America and in other Western states after the end of the Second World War. I'm your host, Alex Kosh, and I'm joined, as always, by my two co-hosts, Sarah Riga and Chuka Ajekam. Hello, guys. Welcome to episode 3.
Hey, Alex.
Hey, Alex. Hey, Sarah.
So we're going to try a little bit more of a informal structure today. So it's just the three of us here. We had a guest, our very first guest, in the last episode. And today's going to be a discussion between the three of us based on a topic that we think is going to be very foundational to this show's frame of analysis, I guess, in terms of exploring the why it is the case that so many Nazi war criminals, fascist collaborators, and the like were not only able to sort of sneak, as it were, into these countries after the war, but were actually embraced and welcomed by many sections of the establishment and states of those countries. And a big reason for that is the simple fact is that elite sections of American, British, and Canadian society were not only comfortable with fascists and Nazis, but actually, in some cases, were very sympathetic. And in many cases, actually openly embraced and collaborated with these far-right sections, especially before the outbreak of the Second World War. So I want to just start this conversation by kind of talking about the real basics of, like, why do we have so many examples to explore? So to give our listeners a little heads up, today we're going to be exploring the specific case of British elites who supported fascism before, during, and a little bit after the Second World War. We're then going to look at the case of the United States, and then finally, Canada. So before we delve into this first example of the UK, which, if listeners have heard my accent, you probably guessed that's where I'm originally from, and this is a lot of examples that I sort of, I guess, grew up with as I sort of came of political age. But the question is, like, why did elites love fascism so much? So I'll hand that open right away to a discussion. Like, why is this the case? Why do we have so many examples to explore on this particular topic?
It aligns with our interests, right? I'm pretty sure that's what we're going to hear here. And thank you, Alex, for going first and, I don't know, explaining your countrymen to us. But I really feel like we're probably going to hit on a lot of the same themes in all of these countries, in that a lot of ways in which these ideologies do benefit people in power, right?
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons I the claim that there's no real difference between the left and the right is so frustrating, because when it comes to structures of power, people who have a lot to lose, if there is a significant political change toward the left, they very quickly identify which is to their benefit. And, you know, as many have said, or as many have pointed out, you can be an elite within fascism. You can't be an elite within communism, at least not in this sense.
Yeah, totally. And I think that speaks to another element of this that we've addressed already quite extensively in the past two episodes, is just how central anti-communism is, not only to supporting fascism, but to embracing Nazis after the end of the Second World War and bringing them into these countries. These are elites who are not only favoring right-wing politics to serve their own interests, but are more, in a sort of more immediate sense, they're more concerned with the ascent of communism in Europe and potentially in North America as well. And that's definitely going to be something that I think we'll see across all three of these different countries, although in slightly different variants.
One thing I'm really, I don't know, curious to get into is kind of what we see in policy around these times, like, you know, where a lot of these positions actually netted out in terms of decisions we see around immigration over the decades, stuff like that. But also how the rhetoric around it swayed that, because I think often when we think of authoritarianism or fascism, we think of very, like, populist rhetoric, which I think can confuse some people, because they kind of think, oh, populist, that's the everyman, that's not an elite. So I'm curious to see, you know, what some of the talking points are here and who they actually benefit, especially once it actually nets out in policy.
The point that you made about the impact that this rhetoric and the resulting policies have on immigration, I think one thing that will also be interesting is sort of noting throughout the 20th century how the particular ethnicities which are identified as being political usurpers, that kind of changes from decade to decade. Obviously, Jewish people are one of the most targeted and most maligned ethnicities in the West prior to World War II. But then, you know, as we'll see, things change quite quickly in a sense.
Totally. It's a moving goalpost that serves geopolitical interests and capital, I think, depending on where the pieces fall at any given time. So, yeah, as I mentioned today, I'm going to start with looking at the case of the United Kingdom, Great Britain, whichever you want to call it. And I think the really distinguishing factor here is the fact that Britain had and still has an aristocracy. Now, there are definitely like sort of kind of proto or different types of aristocrat in the United States and Canada in the sense of sort of high castled elites. But in the case of Britain, I think that what really distinguishes it was we're talking about an ancient blue-blooded aristocrat class and crucially a monarchy. Of course, Canada has the monarchy as well, but in the UK, it is much more visibly present in everyday life and I think more central to the sense of national identity in the UK. And I think what we're going to see emerging here is this real tension in British national identity, because growing up in the UK, two things that really are thrust upon you as defining characteristics of what it quote unquote means to be British are, on the one hand, the monarchy, that is the kind of like constitutional linchpin that brings it all together, that gives it meaning and a sense of or a semblance of legitimacy and grandeur. But crucially as well, another really important aspect of British national identity creating is the Second World War. It's everywhere. It's in the visible signifiers of national identity, the Spitfire, the British warplane that fought German Messerschmitts and bombers in the Battle of Britain, hugely important signifier of British patriotism. The figurehead of Winston Churchill, despite his grotesque racism and imperialism throughout his entire political career, is still very much lauded as a British hero. He is now on British banknotes. He was stamped on the British banknote after I left the UK, but when I recently went home, I did see his face emblazoned on a £5 note. So there's this contradiction we see that, on the one hand, there's these two institutions and this myth-making pieces of myth-making that are really important to defining British identity. But what we find is within the monarchy and aristocracy is support for fascism, particularly before and in some cases during the Second World War. But not only that, absolute collusion with the Nazis.
I'm so glad you're starting there, Alex, because when I told one of my friends that I was planning on recording an episode on this topic, what they said to me was, is it true, like that episode on The Crown, that you know, there was like Nazi collaboration within the royal family. So I'm excited that you'll be able to help me answer my friend's question here.
It's really funny, actually. I just completely coincidentally happened to be watching The Crown right as I was doing this research and happened upon the episode that deals with the topic that I'll be talking about very shortly. It's a very happy coincidence, but yeah, it is real, and I would even argue potentially downplayed somewhat in the case of The Crown, being as it is a popular mainstream British television program. But it is absolutely real, and it's quite shocking, and I think offensive to many tropes of British national identity.
I know you're going to get into it in a second, like what this involvement was, but I guess just from a starting point, like how well known is this in the UK? Like, is this something that most people are aware of having happened?
It's a good question. I don't think I could answer that particularly well. I should caveat that, despite what I said above, you know, claiming to be steeped in British national identity and culture, I haven't lived there for 10 years, so I may be somewhat alienated from how it's actually viewed in the popular imagination, particularly after The Crown. I think most people have at least some kind of passing knowledge of it, but perhaps the depth and crucially the reason for why aristocrats supported fascism, I would argue or would be quite confident, is not widely known at all.
I have a bit of a follow-up to Sarah's question. I do want to say, though, given that we're going to be talking about the monarchy, I think it's important to just make clear that personally, I do not approve of referring to King Charles as Nance Brother Charlie. I don't think it's constructive, and I really would discourage people from saying that. But how How widely known would is it in the UK, Alex, that the Windsor family, the House of Windsor, is of Germanic heritage? Not that that would like not that being of Germanic heritage makes you a fascist, obviously, but there are relationships between the families, literally.
Yeah, absolutely. I think again, to it sort of echoes my last response, and it's in the sense that it is, I think, sort of casually known, or if you like, if you asked someone about it, I think a lot of people would be like, yeah, I had a vague knowledge of that. But again, I think it's the question of the extent that people don't often talk about, at least in my experience. I mean, I don't have empirical studies or data to back that up. But it is important to note that, yeah, the British monarchy, there's two sort of elements to this that I'm just kind of riffing on here, is that on the one hand, yes, the British monarchy did have cousins and relatives who were in Germany at the time of the Third Reich, and so had this very direct family connection to what was going on there. Many of the cousins were enthusiastic Nazis, and sort of by extension that, I guess, kind of rubbed off on some of the British royal family. But that only explains, I mean, it doesn't really explain a lot of it, in my opinion, because there are real class interests that we'll get into in terms of why these aristocrats and royals liked fascism. It wasn't just because they happened to have family ties there. It was because they saw in fascism and Nazism a kind of storm front against the rise of communism, which was a very direct threat to, obviously, their class interests. But not only from communism, there was this kind of ascent of industrial capital as well in the earlier part of the 20th century, in the late 19th century, which in its own right also challenged aristocratic power as well. And fascism, as we'll get into more in more detail, was also a way that they kind of could rejuvenate a sense of importance around their own identity and their own value in society, I think. So getting into it then, I've already sort of hinted then that we see these examples during the war of British monarchs or royal family members colluding with the Nazis, or at least apparently colluding with the Nazis and expressing sympathy for them. And this is often framed in terms of a quote-unquote betrayal. There's actually a documentary that came out in 2022 called Edward VIII, Britain's Traitor King. It's a little, I mean, that he was Edward VIII and he was a king. He was actually the Duke of Windsor. He had abdicated the throne in 1936. And by the time of the documents that kind of exposed this treachery came to light, and when he alleged to have made the claims that were in the documents, he was actually not the king anymore. But what the thing I want to kind of challenge on this premise is the idea of treachery and betrayal. So to give a bit of background, as we've already hinted at then, King Edward VIII, he, as I said, he's most famous for abdicating the British throne in 1936 to marry an American divorcee, which is not allowed, apparently, in the royal family. And he's widely regarded as having been, at very bare minimum, sympathetic to the Nazis. So in 1937, after he left the throne, he's now known as the Duke of Windsor. And in that capacity, the Nazi regime paid for his trip to Germany that year. And this was regarded as a major propaganda coup for Hitler. So Windsor even wrote a personal thank you note to Hitler for the trip. And even in the towards the latter part of the decade, he recorded a speech that was never broadcasted by the BBC. Apparently in its archives, there was a big strip of tape across it saying, "Do not broadcast." And Windsor recorded his speech, I believe, from France, in which he encouraged Britain to avoid war with the Nazis by, quote, coming to terms with Germany. So this is kind of like, this particular statement is less an overt support of fascism, although we'll see that he did have overt support for fascism. And it was more of a kind of like, I guess, an effort at peacemaking.
I guess you're going to get into this a bit, as you hinted at a bit already, him being referred to as a traitor. The way these events were kind of portrayed in The Crown was very much that Edward was a bit of a black sheep in the family. But my understanding, at least of like the current royals, is that everyone has quite significant roles to play. Like they all often go to major functions. It's kind of integral. So I want to hit you with kind of a double-barreled question here, which is one, how much of an outsider was he really in these actions? And also, I'm not sure if you can answer this or if this information is available, but how did he get into this in the first place? Like, how do you get to a situation where the Nazis are paying you for, you know, a lovely little vacation to Germany?
So he got this trip then because he had ties to his cousins in Nazi Germany. And my understanding was that Hitler wanted to court him as a sort of way to get inroads into the British royal family and to sort of use them to avoid conflicts and rivalry with Britain. Now, in terms of whether he's a black sheep, I think there's this kind of unspoken rule in the royal family, and we see it to some extent today, is you're not allowed to embarrass the family in any shape or form. It's why it's really the only reason Prince Andrew, Jeffrey Epstein associate, Prince Andrew, he's kind of on the outside now. I'm not sure exactly what formal steps were taken to sort of ostracize him from the rest of the family. But Edward's crime was abdicating the throne. It wasn't the sympathy he had for fascism and Nazism, which I assume they all knew about before he abdicated the throne. His crime was bringing the institution into disrepute by leaving the throne to marry a divorcee. So he was an outcast for that reason, not because he supported fascism and Hitler.
So you said that you sort of take issue with the premise of the title of that documentary, The Traitor King. So is there in UK society now somewhat a retconning in that he was initially described as a traitor for marrying a Yankee, but now he's described as a traitor for, you know, taking the opposite side in World War II?
So let's explore why he's called a traitor. So that we've seen these other examples that I just listed, and this position of wanting to avoid war with Germany and wanting to maintain cozy ties with Germany, as evil and scummy as we regard it, it was actually quite a popular opinion in the UK before the outbreak of the Second World War. The thing that led to him being called a traitor was found in this trove of documents called the Marburg Files, which were captured from Germany by American troops in the dying days of the war. And these only came to light in the 1950s. They revealed that the Duke of Windsor had effectively encouraged the Nazis to continue bombing Britain in order to push the British public into accepting peace with the Nazis. The sense of treachery is from the fact that it's like you're literally siding with an opposing power in the middle of a conflict. Again, it's not the ideological affinity that has kind of earned him this title. It's that you were fighting for the opposing side in a war. So that, I think, is now why in the British public imagination he is kind of regarded as at least a potential traitor, if not a complete a colluder with the Nazis in the Second World War.
I mean, that is a strong position. Like, keep bombing us. That's a
It's kind of weird that so the documents are, they're actually a diplomatic cable, I think, from a Nazi diplomat who was based in Portugal, and he was relaying a conversation he had had with the Duke of Windsor. I don't think it's a direct quote from Windsor. But nonetheless, you know, it indicates him effectively encouraging the Nazis to keep on bombing British cities and wreaking the carnage that had on British cities and British, as he would call them, British subjects to the crown.
I do think also it's indicative again of how, like, people who imagine themselves to be of not just of an elite class, but like of an elite like species almost, or of an elite gene pool, the lives of regular people are not really consequential for them, because he knows he's not going to die in the bombings and he doesn't really care who does.
That's absolutely crucial to know, I think. And I think this highlights the kind of, the class dynamics that are going to be at play in terms of exploring how we got to this point where he was effectively colluding with the Nazis. So after he left the throne, his brother George VI was also allegedly courted by the Nazis, but I don't think it got nearly as far as it did with the Duke of Windsor. And as I said, the British royal family had cousins in Germany who were big fans of Hitler, and Hitler was very keen to cultivate good relations with the British establishment before the war, understanding that he had few other diplomatic options on the world stage. This is where I want to challenge the betrayal narrative. So in some senses, as I said, it is obviously correct. A member of the ruling class of the UK was essentially encouraging an enemy power to bomb and slaughter his own citizens into submission. Regardless of, like, if you subscribed to the basic tenets of patriotism or nationalism, whatever, you know, your political persuasion is, if someone's siding with the quote-unquote bad guys, whoever they may be, that is treachery in the most kind of literal sense of the term. But it was actually, I think, an extreme act of class loyalty that fascism and Nazism appealed so much to not only members of the British royal family, but the broader aristocracy in the UK. So there's actually a term that's called aristofascism, which specifically refers to the section of the British ruling class that enthusiastically embraced fascism as a sort of traditionalist bulwark against the rise of communism in Europe, but as I mentioned at the top, also against the rise of capitalist class power that challenged the aristocracy's ancient order sort of in its own right. So I just want to quote briefly here from a 2015 article that was published in The Guardian, and it explains, "When analysing the approach taken by the British royal family to events in Germany in the 1930s, key is the pervasive fear of communism among the aristocracy in Europe. In 1933, Edward, later the Duke of Windsor, said of the Nazi regime, quote, it is the only thing to do. We will have to come to it as we are in great danger from communists too."
Yeah, that statement, it is the only thing to do. That is extremely telling.
It's kind of like you were saying, Judah, like this idea that he had of just bombing, you know, his own neighbors essentially is such an extreme thing that you can't possibly come up with something like that in a vacuum. Like, it does really suggest that this is, you know, at least ideas like this were clearly circulating about among his wealthy peers, right?
Totally. And like, you know, the point I want to impress here is not that like he thought messaging the Nazis and saying, oh, goody, if the Nazis win the war, then I'm going to keep my aristocracy. I think it's more like a snowball effect, like his innate sympathy for Nazism, which stemmed from that aristocratic class interest, brought him to that point where, you know, a Nazi victory or at least peace with the Nazis was very much something he could, at the very least, live with, if not openly and enthusiastically embrace.
I think it speaks a little bit, too, to something I've been finding in my research on Canada, in at least that in like the media at the time, there was a lot of coverage of this conflict as political gamesmanship, which I don't think really takes into account the human stakes, obviously, that were involved, and especially like which specific groups of people were being harmed here. It's just a lot of, oh, who wins and how can we make this work and which leaders can be the most powerful. It's a way of talking about politics that I think even a lot of, you know, media does today, that, you know, clearly circulates among these wealthy circles, that takes the humanity out of it.
I'm very curious, in any of your research, did you find any explicit observations made by the UK royal family about what happened to the Russian royal family in the revolution?
That's a really interesting question. No, it's not something I've encountered or looked that much in depth, but surely that would have been weighing heavily on their minds for the entire rest of that century, having seen what happened to the Russian monarchy in the Bolshevik Revolution. So there's a great quote here. This is from an article written by Adam J. Sachs in Tribune magazine in 2020. For listeners who don't know, Tribune is essentially the version of Jacobin in the UK. It's a socialist monthly magazine. I think it's monthly. Sachs explains, "Britain's fascist past is intimately tangled with royals and peers who developed and even institutionalized intensely specific variations of fascist irredentism, occultism, and anti-Semitism." So there's this very peculiar weirdness to British fascism that I think is sort of bound up with Britain's, especially at that time, incredibly ancient semi-feudal class structure that in many ways does persist to this day. So Sachs notes that in addition to the Duke of Windsor's collusion with the Nazis, he also remained silent when the British Union of Fascists terrorized immigrants and Jewish people in British cities. The leader of the British Union of Fascists, which was formed in 1932, was also led by a dyed-in-the-wool aristocrat. That was Oswald Mosley. Actually, at his first wedding in 1920, the King and Queen of England were both in attendance there, which kind of gives you a clue about his incredibly highbrow and high-class connections. Mosley's second wife, Lady Diana Mitford, was the daughter of a baron and a fanatical fascist. She and her sister attended the Nazi Nuremberg rally in 1933 as part of a British delegation there.
Can we just stop there for a second and talk about how bonkers it is to picture just the British delegation to the Nazi rally? Like, I feel like it just at least puts my mind, I don't know about you, when I think about these historical things, it's very black and white movie reels. It's, oh, evil Nazis march in, whatever. It's not actually, this was a political group and there would have been other delegates from other countries and stuff, like, I don't know, clinking champagne glasses and like bumping elbows at it. It's really bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, it's also quite something to view what are obviously massive military formations and think, oh, I'm sure it's all for show. Yeah, like he's, I'm sure nothing will happen.
Yeah, and I think it's what really is kind of shocking to the modern imagination about this is because, and I think we've mentioned this in previous episodes, that Nazis and Nazism is kind of portrayed as the pinnacle of evil that no sane or rational person could possibly feel any kind of affinity or sympathy for. But that was just not the case. In the 1930s, a lot of very powerful, very influential people were very much supporters of the Nazis, and this was not an uncommon feature. So, to give another example, conservative MP Sir Arnold Wilson spoke very favorably of the Nazis. He made several trips to Germany between 1933 and 1937. Upon returning from one of those trips, he declared, quote, "The country is bristling with new ideas and new methods. I have found fresh hope and renewed confidence." And to take it up a level even further, Winston Churchill apparently wrote laudatory comments of Hitler in 1935. He and others were impressed, and this I'm quoting here from an article in the Jewish Chronicle by Bernard Wasserstein. He and others were impressed by the dynamism of the Führer, his oratorical skill, and his capacity to mobilize a great national movement. Churchill soon changed his mind. One reason was his distaste for Hitler's anti-Semitism.
But this is exactly what I'm talking about. I talked about this like political gamesmanship stuff and how it still is this way today. Like, it doesn't matter what someone is saying, but it's like, how good does he say it? Of course Hitler was a great speaker. Like, he was very compelling. I think all the meth he was taking helped, but like, just wild.
It's also very funny to me that it's like Churchill was like, "Wait, Hitler is an anti-Semite? I can't deal with that. Sorry."
Yeah, that is a bridge too far. Yeah.
As if that wasn't already heavily on display for all the world to see. But we have another quote from Churchill here, and I think this explains why Churchill, initially at least, liked Hitler, but also was very sympathetic to Benito Mussolini's fascists in Italy. In 1927, he said, quote, "If I had been an Italian, I am sure that I should have been wholeheartedly with you from the start to finish in your triumphant struggle against the bestial appetites and passions of Leninism." There we have it, folks. It's anti-communism in every case with these people.
It's literally in the water. Like, it's amazing.
Well, I for one, am just certainly so glad that no current leaders are supporting any ideological descendants of Mussolini right now. That's definitely not happening.
Yes, like our own prime minister, of course, wining and dining. What's her name? Giorgia Meloni.
Georgia
Giorgia
Maloney.
Meloni, whose party, the Brothers of Italy, is a direct descendant of Mussolini's National Fascist Party. Why do the West love Meloni? Because she supports NATO, which is the sort of OG Cold War anti-communist institution. It all goes back to anti-communism, folks. So another example of a sort of British aristocrat or elite who loved fascism and was very supportive of it that I want to dwell on for quite a while here, just because of his sort of lasting legacy in British civil society, is Viscount Rothermere, aka Harold Harmsworth. So he is the founder of the Daily Mail and Daily Mirror. These are two very large British daily tabloids that are still in circulation today. The Daily Mail, it's important to know, it's still an overtly far-right anti-immigrant newspaper. It's very much mainstream in terms of its circulation and readership. But this was the kind of like most famously pro-fascist newspaper for a time.
I know this is a full aside, but what is a viscount? Can you explain what that is for those of us who don't have a weirdly hierarchical system of titles in our country?
So according to Wikipedia, a viscount is the fourth rank in the British peerage system, the aristocracy system, standing directly below an earl and above a baron, Lord of Parliament in Scotland. There are approximately 270 viscountcies extant in the peerages of the British Isles, though mostly are secondary titles. So there we go. That's
At a certain point, it becomes like a make-work family structure, like everybody needs a title, everybody needs a territory.
So yeah, he's the founder of the Daily Mail and the Daily Mirror. Daily Mail still very much carrying his torch. So he was primarily a supporter of Mussolini and Hitler, and only briefly championed Oswald Mosley's fascist movement back home in Great Britain. And like most aristocrats, Rothermere loved fascism because he had a deep fear over the spread of communism and viewed fascist movements as the best possible instrument with which to crush it. In an interview with Jacobin magazine in 2020, Catherine Olmsted explains, quote, "Anti-communism is essential to understanding Rothermere's embrace of fascism. He was terrified that a red tide would wash over Europe and eventually get to Britain. So he saw Hitler as a bulwark against Soviet communism. His anti-communism led him to fascism." Now, we've already talked a little bit about, you know, the sorts of why aristocrats were so afraid of communism. And there's another indicator here in the specifics of Viscount's, business in the newspaper industry. So Olmsted says, "In that era, it took a lot of capital to start a newspaper. By the 1930s, it was basically impossible to start a newspaper unless you were one of the richest people in the country. And of course, most of these people had right-wing politics."
I guess if you're running a newspaper, you have a lot of very low-paid staff running the printing presses and all that. And the idea of a workers' movement is probably quite unsettling to you.
Yes, the Print Workers Union in the UK, if memory serves me correctly, were like very militantly organized and actually in some cases caused real problems for the right-wing press as late as the miners' strike, I believe. So unsurprisingly then, Viscount Rothermere, after Mussolini seized power in Italy, he wrote an article titled "What Europe Owes to Mussolini" and expressed his, quote, "profound admiration for the fascist leader." He continued, "In saving Italy, he stopped the inroads of Bolshevism, which would have left Europe in ruins. In my judgment, he saved the whole Western world."
It's like, you'll get one more idea. Like, seriously.
The repetitiveness of this, I do think sort of speaks to the genuine fear and urgency that was pervading through the ruling class in Europe at this time. It's really impossible to overstate just how shit scared they were of this and the means with which they were willing to go to crush it and to stop it. Just another funny quote from Rothermere here as well. He, in 1928, he declared that, quote, "Mussolini will probably dominate the history of the 20th century as Napoleon dominated that of the early 19th. That prophecy was turned upside down, so to speak, towards the end of the Second World War when Mussolini was captured and killed by anti-fascist partisans, the kind of hollowed out puppet of Nazi Germany and really not contributing anything of any significance to the tides of history. But I digress. So Rothermere, the question is then, if he was such a fan of Hitler in Germany and Mussolini in Italy, why was he only temporarily affiliated or a fan of fascists in Britain? So he began to warm to the fascist presence and the fascist party in Britain following the general strike of 1926, during which he accused the British Conservative Party of trying to, quote, appease the workers' movement by being, and I'm quoting again here, "more socialist than the socialists." So he once ran an editorial in 1934 titled "Hurrah for the Black Shirts," the British Union of Fascists donned black shirts mimicking Benito Mussolini's fascists. And apparently staff at the Daily Mail took a cue from this declaration and actually began to wear black shirts to work at the office. And in terms of why he then stopped endorsing Mosley's fascists in Britain, apparently this was likely for commercial reasons. So for one thing, the black shirts weren't particularly popular in the UK, as evidenced by the Battle of Cable Street in 1936, during which thousands of British socialists, communists, and trade unionists stopped fascists from marching through a Jewish neighborhood in East London. But also, at this time, some of the biggest advertisers in the newspaper industry were Jewish-owned businesses. And obviously, if you're going around spouting pro-Nazi, anti-Semitic crap in your newspapers, then some of these businesses are probably not going to advertise in your pages. But although Rothermere kind of turned off of the British fascists, he never really seemed to soften his love for Hitler. Rothermere visited Nazi Germany in 1933 and returned home declaring, quote, "Under Herr Hitler's control, the youth of Germany is effectively organized against the corruption of communism." And despite his initial hesitancy at embracing the Nazis' anti-Semitism, he soon began to parrot the Nazi line on Jewish people. He wrote, this is a crazy quote, "Israelites of international attachments were insinuating themselves into key positions in the German administrative machine. It is from such abuses that Hitler has freed Germany."
From seemingly, so as you said, initially hesitant to toward Hitler's anti-Semitism, for in a period of what, 6 years, he goes from that to, "I believe everything that he says."
Essentially, yeah. Apparently, when people say he's hesitant to Hitler's anti-Semitism, I mean, was he just putting on a show of not embracing it for the commercial reasons I outlined above? I mean, I don't know. I'm not an archivist or a historian, so I don't think I can say with any great authority. But yeah, it does seem a little weird that you would just turn around within a space of a few years and go into parroting these absolutely batshit conspiracy theories. But then again, you know, it does kind of go hand in hand with a key tenet of Nazi ideology. It's the kind of quote-unquote Judeo-Bolshevism conspiracy theory, this idea that, like, communism is a supposedly a Jewish project, and thus anti-Semitism goes hand in glove with anti-communism, which we know Viscount Rothermere was obsessed over.
In some of my research, I did find mention of, I would have to look up the specifics again, but an international conference of one sort or another, in which a number of countries were denouncing the laws that were being implemented in Germany, further reducing the rights of Jewish people, further enabling and endorsing violence against Jewish people. And they would also denounce the, like, sort of public acts of just citizen violence, again, of mass violence against Jewish people. But then when asked to accept, you know, when the German representatives would say, okay, well, we want to ethnically cleanse these people, so, like, you take them all, no country would accept. And then they turned around and said, well, see, you don't want them either. Yeah, I can't, for some reason, that specific line, it's reminding me of something that's happening right now. This may be a government that has used that, basically that exact phrase, but I'm not sure what that is.
Rothermere, as late as June 1939, he wrote to Hitler saying, quote, "My dear Führer, I have watched with understanding and interest the progress of your great and superhuman work in regenerating your country." So the Daily Mail only actually broke with Nazism when Rothermere's son Esmond took over leadership of the newspaper. But all that, as just to stress, the Daily Mail remains a thoroughly reactionary rag. It's a partisan pro-conservative newspaper, but very much on the far right of that party, still borrowing some of the ideas, I would argue, of fascism today. So given Rothermere's very explicit love of fascism and Hitler, like, he was lucky to escape internment at the outbreak of the Second World War. So he slipped off to Canada, supposedly on some kind of mysterious secret mission, and then basically just faded into irrelevance and died in British-ruled Burma during the war in 1940. So as we've heard many examples and quotes here, anti-communism is one of the key, the kind of center stone of why these people turned to fascism. But there's a bit more to it than that. According to Sachs in that Tribune essay, he writes, "If aristocracy has a core, it is the preservation and perpetuation of an elite lineage, which is ultimately about purity of the blood. Even today, for instance, adoptees into aristocratic families in the UK are ineligible to inherit titles or properties, a fact which is not widely known." He continues, "Long before the advent of more modern race theory pseudosciences, this outlook of the English aristocracy provided the fount for the plantation system and racial segregation practiced from Ireland to the Caribbean and the American South. Fascism, in short, broadened the practices and ideas of aristocracy and attempted to develop them for a new century."
I think this quote points out one of the most sinister impacts of allowing a monarchy to exist, even within an ostensibly liberal society, even if you were to call it like capital L liberal society, right? If you accept the claim that such a thing as elite blood exists, you're just fucking opening the door to a whole bunch of horrors.
That's a really key point. I mean, it's like once you've accepted the literal premise of like racial supremacy, which is that there are superior bloodlines than others, which is the kind of cornerstone of aristocracy, then yeah, you've ceded the main founding premise of like the racial supremacy argument of fascism and opened the door to all kinds of other systems of atrocity, as we saw in that quote, imperialism, segregation, apartheid. Dozens of examples that we still see to this day.
Well, so much of fascism, right, is about just this core belief of like this like natural like hierarchy or social hierarchy of people, right? So of course, if you're an aristocrat and you've been born into wealth, like you inherently believe that you deserve that, right?
I'm really I think we'll get a lot out of this as well. I'm looking forward to, well, looking forward is maybe an odd way to describe it, but to see how this plays out in you know, directly colonial contexts like America and Canada, I imagine this will become really visible in the examples that you guys bring to light in the next two episodes.
Yeah, I expect that it will. And admittedly, of course, I acknowledge as well, Alex, that much of what we're discussing is distressing in a sense. I think it is also gratifying to be able to make connections across decades and across political eras. I think it allows, in a world in which the politics of unreality are so crazy making, if I can say that, I think this helps you to sort of situate yourself and find some material purchase in the political events surrounding you. I also do want to say, though, since we're talking about the UK, I don't approve of people calling it the worst island in the world. Again, I don't think it's constructive, and so I would discourage that.
I'm glad you've highlighted these really important points, Chuka, of what we shouldn't be doing and saying about the UK and its institutions.
I'm curious how you see the through line from this to today, like we were just talking about. I don't know if you can talk about that a little bit at all with our current fascination with the royals and there still being a monarchy.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen plenty of examples. I pay very little attention to the sort of everyday happenings of the monarchy. The last time I looked at it extensively was actually when me and Chuka recorded a podcast after the death of Queen Elizabeth, nearly 2 years ago now. But yeah, there is racism endemic in that family. Like we've seen that with the sort of Meghan and Harry conflicts within the family and them making explicitly racist comments to them. It is an irredeemably, unchangingly racist and supremacist institution that it's really no surprise to me that it had so many entanglements with fascism and reflected a kind of broader class alignment with fascism. And so, it's not surprising at all that it sort of has these kind of eruptions of racism and imperialism today. And actually, as well, on the British far right, the monarchy is often invoked as a kind of key symbol of British national identity and patriotism, which, of course, goes hand in glove with their sort of anti-immigrant policies of the kind that we sort of see all over Europe and North America.
Yeah, I think an interesting thing about not just in the UK, but about institutions like the monarchy or figures like Winston Churchill, when they become so central to the country's sort of popularized national identity, is that they're so sanctified that their positions inherently become legitimate. And so regardless of what they are, they have to be acceptable in some way. So, you know, all of the horrendous things that Winston Churchill said about Indian people, it has to be, oh, well, you know, everybody thought that at the time, even though at the time people were like, this guy's a crazy, like insane racist. Like we can't let him do genocide. He really wants to. In the same as the monarchy, the notion that you would ask in advance about the skin color of your grandchild with concern that it might be too dark. It's absurd. It is absurd.
Well, and I think that's why it's so important that we are really talking about how much these powerful and wealthy families, not just obviously, you know, the House of Windsor, but many powerful, wealthy families have benefited from all of this because it allows us to really interrogate these power structures today. And especially in the case of the monarchy, you know, when we look at how financially they've benefited in the past from Nazism and fascism, and not just that, but money from slavery and stuff like that, I think it does really draw into question why, I don't know, for example, the Canadian government is still giving our tax dollars to them.
Yeah, I hope this episode in some way contributes to fueling arguments about how we need to get rid of the monarchy, not only in Canada, but also in the UK. It is a rotten, hateful, evil institution that embodies so much of the kind of murderous, rapacious id of the British ruling class and Britain's legacy of empire and destruction, if I may finish on such a polemical note. Well, thank you very much, guys, for this conversation. Next week, we'll be looking at, I believe, the United States next week. Is that the plan?
Yeah, and surprisingly, very few traces of fascism in the United States. No, I was pleasantly surprised.
After going out in the field with an extensive fascist particle finding gear, you were unable to find nothing. That's
no Hitler particles detected.
Thanks for checking that out for us. Appreciate it.
Great. Well, thanks so much, guys. And thanks to all our listeners. We'll be back with another episode very soon. Take care.